Australian True Crime is an independent podcast. If you help us, we can continue creating and improving our content. That's our promise to you. To support us, simply hit the follow button on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This will help us grow and ensure you're notified as soon as a new episode is released.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
I mean, there are people who see vulnerability and want to protect it, and there are people who see vulnerability and want to exploit it. And obviously, here we're talking about the exploiters.
Patrick Tidmarsh is a criminologist and his specialty is sexual assault. He travels the world teaching police how to interview victims of sexual assault and sexual offenders in the hope that he can have some positive impact on the pathetically low rates of conviction in that area. His new book is called The Whole Story, and like Patrick, it's not clinical or dispassionate. It's not just a collection of case studies about people we can write off as monsters. The Whole Story is a call to arms. It asks us to play our part in fighting the epidemic of sexual assault in our culture. Patrick Tidmarsh asks us to open our eyes and to see sexual assault victims and sex offenders where they really are. Especially when they're in our own homes, and most especially when they are us. He asks us to have the difficult conversations we need to have. He argues that the reason our justice system is failing us on the issue of sexual assault is because it consistently misses the whole story. Patrick Tidmarsh joins us to talk about uncomfortable things. What's your official title?
Well, I don't work for VicPol anymore.
Yeah, right.
My official title when I was there was Principal Practitioner for the Family Violence Command and working on the Sexual Offence and Child Abuse Investigation Team. So your listeners may not know, but Victoria has 28 specialist units, 450 specialist trained sexual assault and child abuse investigators. That's the sockets.
Yep, we talk a lot about the sockets.
Yeah, so the sockets are... The genesis of the sockets is really interesting because I think a lot of police forces around the world, I'm going to go and do some work in the UK next year and this year now. And it's funny, they're in a similar place, I think we were a decade or so ago. So 2004, there was a law reform commission here that looked at the way the system dealt with sexual offending, every agency, and police got a terrible review. Had lost the confidence of the public, and they had cultures of disbelief. I mean, it was a real hammering. And so on the basis of that, and Christine Nixon coming on as the first police commissioner, and sexual offending and family violence beginning to be seen as actually important crimes that ought to be properly investigated, the sockets grew out of that. And myself and a colleague, Mark Barnett, were the first sort of outsiders brought in to work on a specialist training program, because traditionally police forces train themselves. You know, you get a job, you become a detective, you become a boss, then you move to the academy and you teach the same thing to everybody else, which is an absolute recipe for doing the same thing again and again and again, decade after decade. And and in relationship-based crime, really everybody was doing it poorly, but Vic Pohl knew then it was doing it poorly and had to do something different. So that's when we got these jobs. And Mark's job was to improve interviewing of children and vulnerable witnesses, and my job was to improve the interviewing of sexual offence suspects, and along the way change the method of the training, and if we possibly could, make the culture better.
So what was your sort of your major tip? I mean, we've spoken to a lot of detectives and they talk about the way that they speak to suspects, to offenders. Charlie Bazina famously says rapport. You've got to build a rapport.
Yeah.
And Charlie builds rapport with other human beings like nobody I've ever known.
Yeah. Like a salesman.
Yeah. But I mean, I talk to forensic pathologists who talk, who get misty-eyed talking about Charlie when Charlie would come into an autopsy with them. I mean, this extraordinary.
He had a rock star quality.
Charlie would, would come into the room with them, would get the scrubs on, would come in. He's got that sort of touch, likes to get involved with people that way. Ron Idles obviously has great leadership quality.
Yeah.
Narelle Fraser has a real, how do you describe it?
Well, talk about Ron first. He has a real ability to empathize and connect with people who are having the worst moments of their lives.
So true, yes.
And all the good interviewers can do that.
He talks about offenders, people who reach out and touch, grab him to confess to him.
Yeah.
It's like they want him to comfort them as they tell him what they've done. And he's the guy arresting them.
Yeah. Narelle has that quality too. She's kind of the woman you sit next to on the bus, and by the end of the trip, you've told her everything about your life.
Yeah.
You know? So interviewers who've got those things, they care about, they listen to the answers, they care about the person they're talking to, they can connect with them, they're easy listeners, they're always the best. And interestingly, in policing, they were always there in sexual crime, but they were sort of hidden because the culture said, these men are scum, these women are lying. You know, wherever you were in the family violence or the sexual offending area, there was a message that said, don't even bother. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the worst case, you know, when, and this is gone now, mercifully, but when I started in 2007, which is not that long ago, if you had a family violence case, it wouldn't be unusual to hear, oh, why are we bothering? It's just shit versus shit, you know. And so those were the cultural messages about how important you should make this. Like I say, that's kind of dead now, but you can still hear the traces every now and then. And so when we started, you had to go and find the ones that were good interviewers. And there was always one, you know, I think I've written about it in the book. There was always someone, they'd say, you should go and talk to Smithy. Smithy's great with them. And Smithy, male or female, could always sit with someone who's done appalling things, listen to their story, connect, build rapport, and also had the good technique to know how to ask a question and listen to the answer. Mm. And, well, you guys know, you're professional interviewers. Interviewing is about listening. It's not about asking questions, really. It's not about talking. It's about hearing what that person's saying and moving the conversation forward. And the really good ones could do that. And so what we tried to do was make that the norm rather than the exception.
Mm. But we generally talk to nice people. Like, how do you sit can you teach the ability to sit with somebody who you know has been sexually abusing their own children for years and not betray how you really feel about that person?
Yeah, you can.
You can teach that?
Yes and no. So years ago on one of the first courses we ran, I was showing some film of men in treatment talking about their offending and why they did it and how they did it. And at the end of it, I looked up and there was a detective. He'd stood up during the course of the film and he was leaning against the wall at the back of the training room. And I looked at him and said, okay, so do you understand this man? And he was white, with anger. And he said, I will never effing understand him. And I said, I get that. That's not what I'm asking you, not to empathize with him, but do you see the way he sees the world? Because when you interview him, you'll need to be able to connect with him in the way he sees the world. Otherwise, he's not going to talk to you. And he just repeated, I'll never effing understand him. And so the message to a guy like that is, if you can't move past that, then no, you're never going to be able to do this. Mm-hmm. And at the other end of the spectrum, even the really good ones, so was a young woman detective, fantastic interviewer. She had the gift of the gab, charmed the birds from the trees. And this guy was telling her everything in an interview, was babbling away and babbling away. And she asked him how he got into his offending or asked him about the attraction. And he said to her, he looked at her wedding ring and he pointed to it and said, you're married, right? And she said, yes, which was probably a mistake. Tell them, you know, move on. Don't. But anyway, he said, you're married. She said, yes. And he said, you know, the way you're attracted to your husband, that's the way I'm attracted to children. And she took it the wrong way and was instantly angry at him, at the suggestion that they were in any way linked. And he read that anger across her face and he stopped talking to her. So sometimes you get caught in the moment. Sometimes they don't have the talent. Sometimes you just get caught out. But if you can't move past that and focus on what the interview is for, you'll never be any good at this. And so we do sometimes say to people at the end of training, have you thought about working somewhere else? Yeah. You know, because this is not for you. Yeah.
Everything's not for everyone.
Yeah.
Do you think people are afraid that if they can find any level of understanding with a person like that, that that means that there's some of it inside them?
I do think they're afraid of that. And it's a really interesting question because I think most people want to see normal life as one thing and sex offending as something completely different. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it doesn't work like that. It's more that there is a misalignment so that, and offenders know that. That's how they... You know, if you're an offender and you want to target somebody else's children, they've worked out how to do that by using human nature against those parents or against that child. And most of the things, so if you look at the psychology of offenders, the things that make them do what they do or that they use as excuses for what they do, they are sense of entitlement, an inability to take responsibility for their behavior, an inability to deal well in adult relationships, so they move to other relationships that they can control, an ability to deceive themselves of the amount of damage that they're doing to the people that they harm, and so on and so on. Mm. Well, those are really things that we all do to a certain extent, just in a completely different context. So the reality of sexual offending is much more closely connected to us and our humanity than we might like to think it is. And that's a very uncomfortable thing to have to wrestle with. It's tricky to work in this area and you need to understand yourself and why you're doing it.
Yeah.
And then you need to get good at it, because the better you are at it, the easier it is to feel competent and purposeful. Back to your earlier point about you know, how we get our sense of purpose in what we do.
Yeah.
If you know exactly why you're interviewing that complainant and what it is you're trying to get from that, and you know why you're interviewing that suspect, it's much easier to listen to what they're saying and to sit in what is essentially human misery of one kind or another.
And go back to your life.
And go back to your life at the end of the day. Yeah, go back to your husband. Yeah. And look at your wedding ring and not see it as polluted by that man and his comment.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about your book is it really makes you look at the ingrained ideas we have and you explore that about how actually – you know, it's these attitudes as well that is a barrier to actually getting, you know, good investigation and justice for people who or use the word victims, that's the word that you've used in the book. And you opened with a really powerful story about a case where a young girl, 14-year-old girl, had been raped by multiple men in a park in the early hours of the morning. And I have not been able to stop thinking about it. And I also do remember the case to a degree, but would you tell us about that and why you use that? It's I just cannot stop thinking about it because it's the questions that we pose when we hear about these crimes, the kind of prejudices we have, and they're often directed at the victim, not the offender.
Sure. So it was 5 or 6 years ago now, and a 14-year-old girl and I think her 16-year-old boyfriend had snuck out of their respective houses in the early hours of the morning to go to a party, and they were coming back through a park before going back to their separate homes. And a group of young men in their early 20s came through the park at the same time. The boy reported that he was physically assaulted and he ran to get help. And the girl reported that she was sexually assaulted and raped by multiple men within the group. And my colleague was doing radio the next day, the senior investigator on the case. And he was talking about what had happened. And the interviewer said, people are phoning in and texting in about this case. Are you prepared to answer some of the texts? And he said, yes. And one of the first texts through said, what's a 14-year-old girl doing out at that time of night? Mm. And he said, I'm surprised by that question. And the interviewer said, why are you surprised? And he said, because I would have thought the first question is, what's a group of young men doing, allegedly, raping a 14-year-old girl? Applause all around the sexual offence units all around Victoria. Mm. I've thought about it a lot since, and clearly it's had the same impact on you, that why is that the first question? And when I first heard it, I imagined a parent, probably a mother, maybe a father, asking that question. I was trying to think beyond the victim blaming of it and think, why are they blaming in that way? And my first thought was, what they're trying to do is say, please tell me that can't happen to my 14-year-old daughter. And that a lot of times we act out of that instinct of protection, and it's much easier to find one thing that you can blame it on and tell yourself that the world's really okay, instead of absorbing just how awful the world is.
Mm.
And the follow-up to that is, her mother was on Insight a few months later, quite a long time later, I think. And because there'd been multiple men accused who were arrested and charged, she was told by the prosecution that there would be, each man would have a lawyer, each man would have a barrister, and that she would be cross-examined by each of them individually.
Oh, my God.
And she was told that, to quote the mother, the process would be brutal. She withdrew the complaint.
Yeah.
Can I posit another theory also about why we victim blame instead of blaming perpetrators when it comes to these crimes? I think we don't want to face the fact that that perpetrators are raised by us and live in our community. I think that, you know, these are our sons, brothers, fathers, cousins, neighbours, men we work with, boys we sit next to.
Yeah.
They're not monsters that come out of sewers at nighttime.
No, they're not.
And I think that's really difficult to accept. These are boys and men that we love and live with and like and hang out with and know and raise.
Every time I hear the word monster, I grind my teeth.
Right.
It's so unhelpful.
Yeah. Yep. And so this gang of boys live in that neighbourhood. They are guys who work at the petrol station and the butcher shop and all that. And I think that is really hard for us to face up to. And, yeah, they're not monsters. They're not, you know, and it's much easier to say girls shouldn't go out in the morning than my son and his friends shouldn't roam around and rape girls at 4 in the morning.
Much
because
easier.
That's who they are. You know, they are our kids.
They are, and I think it talks to who men are individually, boys too, having worked with adolescents who offend, boys too, there's a lot of offending from adolescents, but it speaks to who they are individually but also collectively, because there's some quite interesting phenomena around group culture and sexual offending when there's groups of men together, and who the leader of the culture is to work out which of those young men would have committed a rape or sexual assault if they hadn't been in the company of others.
Yeah.
And which of those personalities dominates that culture, which suggests the abusive behaviour, who will immediately support it, who will go along with it and doesn't really mind, and who really doesn't want to go along with it but will do it anyway because they don't want to move against the culture of the group.
Mm.
So you've got all those phenomena at play about who we are as men individually and who we are collectively that are really uncomfortable.
And we can't ever have those conversations. You know, I have a son and I would find that really valuable to hear from those young men, from their parents, you know, what did you know was going on with your son? What did you know about his friends? Were you worried about his social circle? That would be valuable, I think. Those conversations would be valuable to have, but we don't have those. We're not allowed to have those. The perpetrator's family is ashamed. They're never going to come out and write a piece for Mamma Mia about the lead up to when my son was charged with raping a girl in a park with his mates, you know?
Not yet. Let's hope they do.
That would be valuable.
I read your piece a while ago. You wrote a piece about pornography and having the discussion around pornography with your son, and made me think about the same thing. You know, we're cowards.
Mm.
We're not having those conversations. We're not listening to the people who are doing it. We're trying to avoid the fractures and the negative messages in our culture about why we are where we are with sexual crime. It's endemic. You know, I mean, you look at the numbers.
But you know that the conversations I'm having are with my 15-year-old daughter, and I often catch myself, and I'm ashamed to say it, but I'm like,
don't wear that.
Do you think you could, could you put a different top on? You know, when you're going out, like I talk about consent, we talk about that, but I do find myself saying, can you just put shorts on that are a bit longer? And I think, why am I saying this? But I just feel this need to be saying it. And she'll say, Mum, why are you like policing my clothing? You're assuming that I'm dressing to attract men. She's like, this is for me, and it's how they like to dress. But I just find myself just going, I just feel very uncomfortable. So I'm talking to her constantly about having to change her behaviour. I don't have a son or anything, but I just think I really cringe when I hear myself say it, but I can't help it. I cannot help saying it.
Why are you saying it?
Because I'm scared. I'm scared for her. I trust her. But I don't trust some people around her. I've got no evidence to back that up, but that's just how it is.
You don't trust men and boys.
Yeah.
I think this is our culture, honestly, is that we're raised not to trust men and boys. We don't think that in our culture are raised to believe that men and boys simply don't have the capacity, the discipline to not hurt women. And as I do have a son, I find myself having to stop myself from saying things like talking about men as though they're dumb animals, and having to say to myself, he is one. Mm. You can't say that. Mm. And I don't say that explicitly, but I realize my messaging sometimes is around this belief that, you know, to a certain degree, they're just incapable of, you know, sometimes they're incapable of appropriate behaviour.
See, that's not that far away from, though, boys will be boys.
Totally.
Which is the excuse for letting them get away with it.
That's how I was raised, and obviously that's the way I guess Emily was raised.
It's a double-edged sword,
isn't
it? Not?
And you know, and I've got no, evidence or experience to, well, you know, of course we've all got experience with things that have happened years ago and blurry lines, but I'm 45, so, you know, go figure, it's happened. But now there's so much more awareness, and I've got great men in my life, father, husband, all that, but I just still can't shake this fear that, I don't know.
See, even then I was feeling like I was hearing you minimize assaults in your life. All of this is saying to me, sort of take me back to earlier in our conversation when you were saying that the police had this attitude, it's shit against shit or whatever, right? Bad attitude about way in the past about working hard and investigating these cases. But now I think, gosh, it must be hard for them to keep their morale up when the stats are just so against convictions in sexual assault, in even getting victims through the process, getting them through court. Like, how do you train investigators to keep their motivation up and to just stay the course?
Wow. So the criticisms in 2004 were about not listening primarily and not having the knowledge base to understand what they were hearing, even if they were listening.
Mm.
So the SOCOW, which were the uniform members, usually women, came in for the least amount of criticism, because actually lots of the statement taking was quite good. But then when it got moved to a detective who was usually a man and who had never met the complainant, that's when everything fell apart. So what VicPol's done, a number of other forces, any force that's doing it well, has prioritised listening, taking statements, doing good interviews, gathering complete evidence as much as they can. Police forces nearly always attract the most criticism, but to a certain extent it isn't fair, because even if they were brilliant at their job and produced briefs of evidence that were powerful and persuasive of what had taken place, there is a phenomenon in the criminal justice system called downstream orientation, and it basically works like this. So the public hold views and attitudes about sex and sexual offending and punishment and so on, lots riven with myths and misconceptions, and I'm sure we'll talk about them later on. And so then those members of the public become police officers. So you got your primary problem is you have to make sure they don't hold those views by the time they're listening to these stories. So then the next pressure point comes when someone comes in and tells their story, and it might be confusing, like, why did she wait 2 weeks to report, or why did you keep going around to the guy's house, or how drunk were you? So they've got all those elements that say, oh, gee, this one's going to be hard to persuade someone. So if you can get over that hurdle, then you get it to the senior officer who says, right, now we need to determine, is there a reasonable prospect to conviction? This is kind of chilling term in a way. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason? Mm-hmm. Who knows what the answer to that question is? But you ask a lawyer who's prosecuting, their view will probably be the one that the police officer is holding in mind,
mm-hmm.
and thinking, well, what will they think? Rather than making their own decision about what they think, they'll go, well, what will the prosecutor think? Because the prosecutor's thinking, well, what will the juror think?
Yeah.
Which brings you right back to the beginning with the general public who sit on juries and who hold those myths and misconceptions. And there's loads of information about how many we hold, why we still hold them, about why do they continue relationship, why weren't there injuries that people expect there to be, why has their memory got that gap in it and not this gap, and so on.
Yeah.
And until we, one, understand how many misconceptions that there are, but two, and I think more importantly, realise that the biggest blocker in the system is actually us.
Are society's attitudes changing? Because we were also talking earlier about the fact that our kids, who are all sort of early teens or mid-teens now, would be horrified at all of this.
Mm.
Our kids are think very differently.
They'd be disappointed in you two.
Yeah.
Very.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They would.
And their vocab is different.
Yeah.
Their whole understanding of expectations are just very different. And I do believe that they would follow through. I do believe they would.
Well, look
who's
leading the charge. I mean, it's Grace Tame, Chanel Contos, Brittany Higgins. The vast majority of people are offended by people they know, but 85% plus. So you know there's a relationship there of some kind or another. Of the 15% that happen out in public space, the majority of those people are known to each other as well.
No.
So I won't say that sex offending from strangers is rare, because it's not that rare, but it's a very small proportion relatively of sex offending. So you know that those people knew each other for a period of time, and that relationship, I mean, if you're good at investigating this, that actually is where the evidence is. And a lot of the time, the evidence that's most impactful, that changes our minds or helps us understand what took place, happens before the offending itself even begins.
Yeah.
It's in that preparation, what we know is grooming. And I mean, grooming is often misunderstood in some ways. I think a lot of people think grooming is just about the sexual element of the relationship, but actually it's the power and control and authority elements that are much more important. They're what stop people reporting. They're what keep people involved in relationships that are damaging them, and so on. So fight, flight, freeze, surrender, I think is our shorthand of telling people, whether they're police investigators or the public, that the world is actually not round the way they think it is. It's completely upside down. Because when we ask any group, take aside political correctness, what would you like a victim of sexual crime to do? Their answers are either fight back or run away. Mm. And that is a relatively rare response, mostly because by the time someone makes that choice, it isn't really a choice anymore. It's an inevitability because of the manipulation in the relationship. And we generally only fight back or run away in a split moment before our brain can tell us that we need to think about it. Mm. So it's an immediate instinctive decision. Certainly fighting. Running away, and I wrote about it again in the book. I've done hundreds of jobs, and very, very few times has someone run away. And the only times they have is when there was a clear path to safety or someone interrupted in some way so they could go to that person. It's quite rare. So the most typical response is freeze behavior is really interesting. Now, tonic immobility, it's called, if any of your listeners want to look it up, tonic immobility. It's been studied for decades in animals and humans and including in rape victims. And so it's now quite commonly argued in court that freeze behavior is typical.
Is this what we talk about colloquially as rabbit in the headlights?
Sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what we humans tend to do under threat is nothing. Until we understand the nature of that threat and how to survive it. So it's been successfully argued in Australian courts for a while now that so defence is finding it harder to get, you know, that in as an anomaly in some way. But I think the one we find hardest, that's back to a number of the elements of the conversation we've had already, is this idea of submission or surrender or compliance, that it feels so awful to acknowledge that that is the most typical behavior, but it is. And you see it in family violence, you see it in child sexual abuse, you see it in adult sexual assault and rape. The most typical response is to do nothing and comply because it's what our survival mechanisms tell us to do.
Mm. You mean like kind of wait for it to be over? That kind of.
Yeah, live through it, live through it, yeah. survive it. You know, I'm thinking about one case we. I can't remember what happened with it now, whether it got prosecuted or not. I wish I could. But a woman, it was an acquaintance rape, and they had been out together for dinner, went back to one or other place. She didn't want very much in the relationship. He wanted sex. And by the time she realized he was going to do it anyway, she reached into her handbag, got a condom, and said, if you're going to do it, put that on.
Yeah.
And no, it didn't get prosecuted now, I remember it, because of that conversation about how on earth will we persuade a jury that that isn't a consensual moment rather than a survival moment. And in a way, for me, that's a kind of benchmark. If we can get, every time that happens, we can get a jury to understand it as a sensible survival mechanism of behaviour, and has nothing to do with consent whatsoever, then maybe the system's moved on and improved.
Yeah, and that makes me wonder, and obviously I don't know anything about that victim or anything about her life, but all of this is making me wonder about how a person's history can affect the way they react in a situation and how it can be that victims can be targeted by multiple offenders. And we've talked to victims about this before. It's a topic that comes up oftentimes because we know that people can say, oh, I ended up being victimized by a number of perpetrators and I don't know why. And I used to think it's me. I attract them. I do something? And it's just obviously an awful situation, but it's not uncommon, is it?
Not at all.
And is there any kind of understanding academically about how this happens? And I always wonder, is there a certain kind of way that if someone's been really successfully groomed once, perhaps as a younger person, is it almost as though the grooming is already done when another perpetrator comes along and they can kind of recognize that? Or is it that I don't know, you're already fearful that if you say no, you'll be hurt, so you don't ever say no again, or like, I don't know.
It's a delicate subject, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got listeners who have lived experience here, I want to be careful not to suggest that they have a mark upon them, or they have a mechanism that...
Or that there's one answer to my question, I guess.
No, because there isn't.
Answers.
So I think the most important thing to say is that offending starts with offenders.
Yes.
And oftentimes when we listen to a story, we're actually judging the victims. As one,
well, that's the only answer, right? The only thing we know for sure is that it's never the victim's fault. And that's the main thing, is like they can come away from this situation thinking it must be me because nothing else makes sense, when in actual fact we know obviously it's not them. So there is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if they're reporting to a police force that doesn't know what it's doing, as one very honest senior officer in a different country said to me just the other day, she said, effectively, we're investigating victims now. We're not investigating suspects because we're looking at them to go, well, where's the problem with this story? And so their job now is to change their culture around and their thinking around and have offender-focused investigations, because it isn't that she keeps finding the wrong man. The wrong man finds her. And so there is an element of the answer to your question that is, yes, they will find vulnerability. They will test vulnerability and either find it or create it. And so if there's been damage that they haven't worked through in some way or another, then he'll see it, offender will see it in a way that, I mean, there are people who see vulnerability and want to protect it.
Yeah.
And there are people who see vulnerability and want to exploit it. And obviously here we're talking about the exploiters.
Yeah. And I guess if you have enough girlfriends, you might eventually find one who, you know, shows the fearful response that you're looking for example, and things like that, that you can then keep working on.
Yes, or you can move. So the one I use in training is a massage therapist story. And he has a routine to manipulate. So when the new client comes in, target, I suppose, in his mind, he will make a slightly inappropriate comment. He will tell them to take all their underwear off. He will not leave the room at dressing time, but simply turn his back. He will move through a series of small tests to see, well, how are they reacting to that? And if they don't go, are you going to leave the room, or no, I think I'll keep my underwear on, thank you, or do you have any ones I can put on instead, or if they don't challenge the rhythm of his process, then he'll keep going to the point of offending. And most offenders have some version of that testing process. There's 2 5% that are really useful for everybody listening to know if they don't already, and I'm sure most of them do. But so false reporting comes up a lot.
Yes.
And
what do you mean by that? It doesn't happen a lot, but the idea of it comes up a lot.
The idea of it comes up a lot.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
But actually, the reality of false reporting is only about 5%. And of that 5%, I think a lot of people think that's a malicious 5%, but the biggest group in there are people with mental health problems. And oftentimes when we get those stories in and what they're saying is provably false, they're actually trying to tell the investigator something that either historically or contemporaneously has happened to them. They're just not able to articulate it. And malicious false reporting is way smaller than most people think it is. So for me, that's a really important 5% to remember. The other 5% that's useful and connected to this story is that when Mark and I looked at the figures of with that expectation that if something bad happened to you, you'd immediately go and tell someone. So most people think you should report immediately. So we looked at 1 in 8 women reporting sexual assault or rape, and it's harder to tell with children, but say 1 in 10 children talking. Then we looked at all the people who'd reported to VicPol in that year, and an immediate report is classified here and in lots of police forces within 72 hours of the event itself. And then we looked at the numbers that had reported within 72 hours. We found of the total numbers, only about 5% report straight away. So it is much more likely that people will wait to see whether they want to, what the consequences might be. And of course, the longer we wait, the less likely we are to tell. So in that particular story, she waited 2 weeks. She phoned her sister immediately afterwards, and her sister said, you've got to go to the cops. And she said, oh, nah. I, I, And the reason she said she didn't was she wasn't sure they'd believe her. She was worried they'd think she'd gone for a happy ending and it had all gone wrong, or some kind of awful misjudgment like that. And then she thought, I'll stuff it, I'll just get over it. And she found very quickly she was struggling to sleep. Then she stopped eating and she had a job she loved. And it wasn't until she drove to work, parked her car and couldn't get out of the car because she was shaking and sobbing that she thought, fuck this, I'm going to the cops. And in some ways, that used to be seen as a problem with investigators. Oh, what are we going to do about the 2-week wait? But actually, for me, I think that that is something that is relevant evidence we can explain to someone and say, this is why she waited 2 weeks. That's actually quite typical behavior and very understandable behavior. I don't think it gives us a problem at all. Mm-hmm. But historically, we used to kind of hide those things. Like we'd hide the fact that there were no injuries. We'd hide the fact that she waited 2 weeks or there was an inconsistency. Whereas now, you know, good investigators know, don't hide it, explain it. Ask her why. And I found her story of waiting 2 weeks utterly compelling. And at the end of that, she didn't even need to tell me about the offending in some ways, because you tell me what happened afterwards, completely absorbed, and I would have thought, yep, guilt.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We'll see.
Thank you to the following patrons: Julia Cash, Amanda Borshop, Eileen Walsh-Thomas, Amanda Fernley, Jessica, Cara Mockett, and Jasmine Kosicki. I just keep thinking, well, what is the answer? Like, how is this going to change?
Right. 2 minutes go. Let's start in the justice system, I think, because in some ways that's the easiest. If we... like the Swedes, for example, they have affirmative consent, as we now have in Tasmania and New South Wales, coming into Victoria. But they've gone further than that. They have changed laws now. So rather than just rape and sexual assault, they have negligent rape and negligent sexual assault. So the expectation on anyone engaging in sexual relationships is that they must have communicated with the other person to determine whether or not they were consenting to that. And if they didn't, that will lay them open to a charge of negligent rape or negligent sexual assault. And of course, obviously, you can prosecute the more serious type of rape and sexual assault as well. So they've decided to educate their young people and adults in consent and sexual relationships. I mean, they've been doing it for decades, I think, better than most places in the world. So from kindergarten up, sex is seen as a part of relationships, and so consent is effectively taught from kindergarten onwards, and how to negotiate, how to communicate. So there's a cultural effort at one end to change or maintain positive relationships, and at the other end, there are clear and significant punishments that are much more likely to be prosecuted than the bigger charges. Because one of the issues with, right back to your comment you made before about, oh, they were both so drunk and or they were this or whatever excuse people have got. If you're going to make a judgment that someone's committed a rape, that carries a huge sentence potentially. So sometimes you'll hear jurors in studies say, I'm pretty sure he was guilty, but I didn't think the punishment fitted the crime. And I think the Swedes have kind of taken that on board and said, well, right, well, we'll make the punishment fit that crime, because not all rapes are the same. I mean, to a certain extent they are. They're all acts against consent. They're all acts of violence to a certain extent. But within that, there's a wide variety, and they've recognised that some are easier to prosecute than others, and so they've shifted their laws. To pick up on the education, I mean, if you looked at someone like Marie Crabb's site, It's Time We Talked, and the way she talks about pornography, and I spent 14 years running a program for young people who have sexual behaviour problems and sexually offend, and they knew an awful lot about offending in some way or another, but they didn't really know about sex, and they really didn't know about relationships.
That's the thing about porn, isn't it? And I was just, the kids and I were talking about that the other night, and I know I always kind of probably pitch it a little tiny bit too old for them, but right. Because the other night we were talking about, I love the idea that the Swedes begin at kinder, because I think, you know, sex doesn't begin with penetrative sex. It begins with holding hands, with kissing, with all of those things that begin really little. And it's like when people used to force kids to kiss other people. Give him a kiss, give Uncle Rob a cuddle, all that. And we used to force them, you know, and now we know better. We don't do that anymore. But asking for consent to kiss somebody, kiss your little friend at kinder and all that, that's important, isn't it? Because that's the beginning of the idea of respect and consent. And I was saying to the kids the other night, and they hated it, but that porn isn't sex. It is not normal. You know what brought up the conversation, actually? It was Billie Eilish. Did you read Billie Eilish's comments about it?
Yes.
And they were so brilliant when she said that she saw porn as a young kid. It was disturbing. She wished it had never happened. It ruined her brain, she said. It ruined her first sexual experiences. And we were talking about that, and I said to the kids, you got to understand, it's like the difference between the zoo and Jurassic Park.
Yeah,
you know, it's like,
that's,
you know,
very true.
The zoo is real animals, Jurassic Park is dinosaurs. Well, sex is one thing, and porn is stupid. It's ridiculous, but you can't look at porn and think, when I have sex, it's going to be like that. That is not real.
And the access to it, it's like back in the day,
right?
You might see a penthouse or something. That was it.
Right.
Now it's like, so pick up the phone, anything you want.
It doesn't surprise me that young sex offenders wouldn't actually know a lot about sex.
No. She also said that she did things she'd rather not have done because they were a part of that, and as she got older and reflected on it, she wished she hadn't done them. And she
Billie Eilish did.
Yeah, because she wished them because she'd seen them. And I think, look, pornography has also changed quite a bit in the last 10, 15 years. It's clearly much more aggressive now. And that kind of normalizing of aggression in porn is really quite disturbing and dangerous. And it's interesting, I read an article just the other day about how the younger generations now are having quite a bit less sex than we did in my generation. And I'm a bit older than you, but in yours too. And marking out that a reaction to porn is a part of that, and seeing that as quite scary and not something I want to engage in.
I'm not surprised.
I'm not surprised either.
No.
When we started the program working with young people, so we started in 1993, we started the Male Adolescent Program for Positive Sexuality, we called it, because we didn't want to call it the Sex Offender Program. And when we started in 93, there wasn't an internet. So they were, getting it out of their dad's cupboard or their older brother or whatever it was. But by the time I went to work for VicPol in 2007, every kid was using internet and porn then. And I'm sure that's at least stayed the same, if not got worse.
Totally.
The question then is, how many of them would be offending if they hadn't come across pornography? And I think there is no doubt that it is having an influence and creating more offending than would be the case if it weren't. And some of that is the availability, and some of that is the nature of it, the choking, physical abuse as seen as a part of that, as part of the thrill of that. Young people trying to navigate that, particularly if they haven't had a solid grounding in relationships and consent and had education that pornography how to manage pornography, it's going to confuse some
young people. And someone needs to tell them that women don't really like that, because honestly, in pornography, it's portrayed as enjoyable for everybody. And I think there's a growing misunderstanding for young men in particular that a lot of those acts are enjoyable, that a lot of debasing acts and acts that are frankly painful for women are enjoyed in the movies, in the pornography, are enjoyable. And I think then there's that young women are taking on this idea that, I must be the only person who doesn't like it. And then so it's this real, really practical subversion, I think, that's gone on out there from when I speak to people. It's really bizarre. And I'm like, aren't your parents talking to you? Like, people need to say, that's not real, guys.
No, it isn't. And Marie was, I recommend It's Time We Talked, get everyone go there. But I remember her telling me a story of doing a lecture in a school and one of the girls challenging her when she talked about rough sex being, absolutely everywhere in pornography. She said, what's wrong with rough sex? And her answer was better than one I'm going to give. But if I remember it roughly, it was, it isn't that some people don't like it. It's that it's everywhere and it's seen to be normal and actually way fewer people. So anal sex, for example, is everywhere in pornography. But when you ask people whether they practice that in their own lives, I think the figure is about 15% of people roughly say it's a part of our sexual practice.
I'm so glad you brought up anal sex. I've been dying to.
Not a lot of people say that.
Well, again, we don't hang out enough because that is a classic example to me. It's like, people now think that is normal sex, right? That's just part of, that's ABC, like that's third base.
I'm
like, kids, no.
Third base?
Like, that's what I'm saying to you.
How many bases are there?
I don't know. I think the bases are the same.
It's definitely something with consent between two consenting adults. You would certainly build up to that over a time and maybe even, I don't know, months.
Oh, no, birthdays and special occasions. Yeah. I get it. But
it's not straight off when you're like, you know, a young, like teenagers. Yeah.
Oh, no. It's every single time. And it's, you know, it's just part of the menu. Like,
yeah, no.
That's what I'm trying
not
to say.
Not my menu.
Kids. I don't bring it up with the kids specifically, anal, but I am saying to them, that's not, please understand.
Yeah.
That's not normal. That's not what every couple's doing. It's not normal. But I think there is it's just subverted the paradigm in people's minds about the basics.
The same's true around body shape and changing body shape and pubic hair.
Pubic hair.
Now seen as a fetish. So.
I talk about pubic hair all the time with my, makes it sound weird, but my beautician will say, I ask her, you know, you go in for a bit of a tidy up. I'm like, what do most people get? She goes, all off. What's the one that's all off? XXX, Brazilian. Yeah. She goes, not many people have.
Technically a little landing strip.
But what's the one? But often she goes, the young girls don't want pubic hair because of what they see.
They don't know. Yeah, that comes from porn, which is just like, to get a better shot.
But I do often say to the girls, it's very natural. It's protective. It's just, you know, it's all, you know.
What was the thing that it came out of the French brothels? Oh, I can't remember. It was to make the girls look younger. That's what it was. Mm. That's where it came from initially.
I think, for me, the most disturbing of all of that is just – that we're blurring that. If you look at what's available online, for me, there are a number of disturbing elements, but and I'm not against pornography per se, or certainly I wouldn't want to move to that, let's ban nudity and ban expressions of sex. It's not about that. It's more about looking at what it's influencing, because porn is setting the context for young people in particular understanding sex, and so we need to be able to talk to them about that. But if you were to go online and just type porn into your search engine, the first and biggest category by far would be teen.
I know. It normalizes all these weird things like stepmother and brother-sister. And like all of those things come up in like general searches. You don't have to go and look for them. But I mean, I was like probably 17 when I saw porn for the first time, you know.
And really,
I found it educational, believe me. Yeah. But I mean, imagine being 11 and it wasn't this kind of porn, you know.
No,
it wasn't this awful, aggressive, violent stuff.
I mean, two things really. If people are listening to this and they have lived experience or they know someone has lived experience, I've been working with students for the last couple of years, and I have been shocked after all these years working in sexual crime. I have been shocked at the amount of abuse happening to young women. Mm. I knew it was there, but when you work with students all the time, just seeing it and feeling the anguish and the just how much is happening, I really hope that these movements taking place now, particularly with young women leading the way, make a difference. And I'm also aware that institutions are still lagging behind and trying to protect themselves with lawyers or put policy in but not really enact it. So the answer, to go back to your question before about what do we do about all of this, is we look at everything. We look at our own courage and our own honesty. We look at the conversations we're having at that basic level with our children. We give a lot more money to kindergarten teachers and anyone working with families and children, first 7 years of life, all of that.
That's right, because we can't just suddenly turn around and say to men, you know, 14-year-olds, 18-year-olds, 30-year-olds, oi, it's consent from now on, away you go.
Yeah. Mm.
When you know? They've been exposed to porn at a young age, and can they reasonably be expected to be responsible for things they do when they're teenagers if they've been exposed to that?
Or to women, you know, we can't just suddenly say to human beings, oi, these are the rules around respect, and this is what you should expect, and this is how you should treat women. And it's like we were saying before, you know, they need to be learning that from the day they're born. Mm. Don't you shudder now to think about like forcing little kids to kiss and hug people?
I do.
Even sit on Santa's knee.
Yeah,
it's
all
creepy
that stuff when they didn't want to.
So what interests me though is what your daughter said when you questioned what she was wearing. I mean, she's just not going to put up with that anymore, is she?
And I love it because I'm like, yes, I sort of feel confident because she's just she calls me out on it. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah. And my husband's actually, he's far more like he's just, he never says stuff to her like that, which I love, but I'm the one, it's me. I'm the one going, can you not buy so many crop tops? Maybe get something that covers up, you know?
I don't know. Men understand the fear. I think it goes back to that idea of, you know, when Eurydice Dixon died and those moments and I Am Asawi, when we would be so frustrated and saying, you don't get it. You don't get what it's like to not be able to go places and do things because you're scared. You don't know what it's like to have to think, oh, is it too late to go for a run? Is it too late to?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Oh, I can't.
We don't get it, though. We don't. We don't. Because we don't move. We don't move through the world in the same way. Yeah, we don't.
You know, and I remember that lady, someone posted online about her friend said, oh, God, it's just my favourite thing to walk home from uni at night listening to, you know, my favourite album. And she was just like, fuck you. You just have no idea how privileged that is. Like, I could never do that, listen to headphones and walk home at night from uni.
That's one of my hopeful things working with students is when in one of, I can't identify it, but in a particular area of the uni, when the young women explained what you were just talking about, like what it's like to be us and what pisses us off when you say this or do that, that year group went, right, that won't happen here. And so that group kind of went through their next 2 years of uni all together, where the young men and the young women were, as far as one could tell, in lockstep with what was going to be considered okay and what was not, and what would happen if anyone crossed that line. So I think what I'm also hopeful about young men, when they hear what is and isn't okay, and we're talking to them from early ages, they are generally receptive. I mean, most of the young men that I grew up with and most of the men that I know now are very receptive to this and absolutely do not want to behave in a way that is offensive, obnoxious or dangerous.
Yeah.
But we've got to work at it, I think, and we really have to listen to what Billie Eilish and
powerful,
and others are saying and do something about it.
Patrick Tidmarsh's book, The Whole Story, is available now. If you're in immediate danger in Australia, you should call 000. If you want to report a sexual assault within Australia, you can call 1-800-RESPECT 24/7 on 1800 737 732. You can also call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
Thanks to the following patrons: Jamie Lee Egan, Susie Wolfe, Catherine Londrigan, Sarah LaRose, Tom Sheridan, Hayley Tolcher, and Sally Dowd.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
This has been another Smart Fella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Marc Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Marc.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.